Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Eamon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Deirdre, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad at all. Will you be donning your Stetson and heading up to see Garth Brooks next month?
I genuinely wish I was. Yes, I am a big Garth Brooks fan and I would love to be at the gig, but no, I'm not going.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would have thought you weren't now, because I know you like your heavy rock too, don't you? But you like a bit of country.
Oh yeah, yeah. But see, think about it. When you think about it, sort of a lot of American country and western, if you like, I'm trying to take names off the top of my head, Brooke Shelton, is it, or Shelton Brooks, whoever. A lot of these guys, it's actually a very crossover between rock and country, because if you look at the backing bands they have, they've got substantial rock elements to it. So, you know, there's where the interest comes from.
Yeah, there you go. I suppose I like a bit of Garth Brooks myself. Well, listen, we're going to take general queries this week, Eamon, if that's all right with you. And remind our listeners that if you have anything you'd like to ask Eamon, maybe you're feeling a bit under the weather yourself, maybe somebody in the family is, phone those questions through to Padraig on 066 712 3666. Now, Caught was in touch and she says she suspects her teenage daughter is vaping, but she won't admit it. Does Eamon know if vaping is dangerous to a person's health? Is it as bad as smoking?
Okay, so the answer to that is it's less worse, but it's not harmless. And that's the difficulty. Okay, the difficulty with smoking as opposed to vaping is that smoking, you're inhaling huge numbers, hundreds of potentially harmful chemicals. The problem is that in the middle of all of that, you've got the nicotine, which is one of the most addictive drugs known to mankind. And smoking is probably the most effective way to deliver that drug, nicotine, to the person's brain in the fastest possible way, which makes it super addictive. The problem is you've got all the other burn products in the cigarette, and they're the things that cause the damage in the short and definitely in the long term. Vaping, which I think is slightly better regulated on this side of the Atlantic than the far side of the Atlantic, involves the inhalation of essentially a steam. It's not a smoke. So it's, I think they call them, it's the burn cigarette as opposed to the e-cigarette. And you're inhaling essentially a steam rather than a smoke. Again, the difficulty is that it's not so much the one-off, but it's where it's being repeated over a period of time. I think that, okay, the evangelists for vaping, and indeed it's interesting that a lot of the major cigarette companies and tobacco companies have moved into this market and are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into it. That the evangelists would say that vaping is a pathway out of smoking, but what we're all concerned about is that it's the reverse, it's a pathway into smoking, that it's a gateway drug.
Okay, yeah, and the worrying thing, I was mentioning this to colleagues earlier when I saw that question coming in for you, Eamon. I was downtown last night for the Rosa Tralee Festival around the amusements, and the amount of teenagers that are vaping, and I suppose, you know, the way teenagers will try a cigarette at that age, you know, it's to be cool or whatever, but they seem to be going straight to the vaping now.
Yeah.
It's kind of worrying, I think.
Okay, and I have no idea. I have no idea whatsoever about relative costs. Cigarettes are expensive. I have no idea how much the vaping costs, but I wonder whether that's a factor in this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mid-Kerry listener's been in touch, Eamon, and says her daughter, who is just 21, has carpal tunnel. Is that unusual for someone so young?
No, the problem is that carpal tunnel syndrome is a so-called overuse injury. So again, for people to explain what a carpal tunnel syndrome is, at the wrist, there is a quite a tight space through which all the structures of the wrist pass through. So you've got a bone at the back, bone on either side, and then across the front, you've got a sheet of quite tight, tense tissue. And in the space in between, you have some muscles, but mostly the ligaments that move the fingers. You've got nerves, you've got arteries and veins. And the problem is that if you're using it a lot, these areas can get inflamed and cause swelling. The problem is that because they're within a very restricted space, there's nowhere for them to swell, I should say. And what happens then is that the softer structures, particularly the nerves, get compressed by the swelling, and that in turn is what causes the symptoms of the carpal tunnel syndrome. Short term is trying to identify the activity that causes this, though in many cases it's work related, so it's very hard to avoid. There are things that can be done in terms of things like keyboards and positioning of keyboards that can help. Splints can be useful. Physiotherapy can certainly help. Sometimes in very intractable cases, the person requires a surgical operation to actually split that sheet of tissue on the inside of the wrist to create a bit more space, but that tends, fortunately, to be the exception rather than the rule.
Okay. Texter wants to know, does Eamon know if there is a cure for, now I'm not going to attempt to pronounce this, but it looks like blepharitis or dry eye.
Not a cure, but treatments. So there are two probably related but different conditions. Dry eye is exactly as it says, it's dry eye. And some people, unfortunately, don't produce enough tears. Ironically, you can have a situation where the person isn't producing enough tears, but their eyes are watering all the time. And what that's about is that the front of the eye, the cornea, the bit where the lens is probably the most sensitive part of our bodies. It's really exquisitely sensitive. And in the normal course of events, what will happen is that the tears that are produced in the tear glands above the eyes sweep across the front of the eye to wash away any dust and dirt, and then to disappear down a little duct on the inside of the eye down into the back of the nose where the tears evaporate. In addition to that mechanism, there's a separate mechanism whereby little oil glands present in the upper and lower eyelids secrete an oily substance that waterproofs the front of the eye. Now, if there is not enough tears being produced, and you can get this in connection with some of these so-called connective tissue disorders, you get a condition called Sjogren's syndrome, which is associated with things like rheumatoid arthritis. That can cause an issue. The other problem is that if there isn't enough of the oily substance being produced, if the front of the eye isn't being waterproofed, then what happens is that the tears don't form a film over the front of the eye. It kind of breaks up. And ironically, then what will happen is that the person will produce more tears, so as that they're literally their tears streaming down the face, even though I've got dry eyes. The blepharitis bit of it is that those glands that produce the oil themselves can become inflamed. Sometimes the oily substance dries up and forms a little plug in the ducts, the little passageways out of them. Sometimes become infected. And in fact, when somebody has a sty in the eye, that's what an infected gland is. So what do you do? Bathing, trying to keep the eye as moist as possible. The purpose of the bathing really is to try to break down any crusting along the eyelids so as to allow this oil to be produced, to allow it to get out of the glands so there's less likelihood of infection, and also to do its job in terms of waterproofing the front of the eye.
We have a lady who's 74, Eamon. She's been taking Parnate and Stelazine for seven or 8 years. She's now stopped taking them and is getting really bad headaches. Are the headaches connected to stopping the medication? What kind of medication is that, first of all, anyway?
Yeah, first and foremost, I suspect that she's been taking them for longer than 7 or 8 years. Those are two antidepressant medications, and they're also used as mood stabilisers. But they are a really old class of medications. They're called the MAOIs, monoamine oxidase inhibitors. For the most part, they've fallen out of favour because there are newer, more effective drugs with less side effects. One has to be really careful about your diet when you're on these drugs. And I strongly suspect our listener would have been put on these drugs not 7 or 8 years ago, but probably 30 or 40 years ago. The thing is that stopping the drugs, particularly if it is done under the supervision of the psychiatrist or the mental health specialist who would have started it in the first place, would be unlikely to cause headaches. And unfortunately, that's probably something else as a cause for the headaches that in its own right should be followed up.
Okay. Male in his 70s says he's been prescribed, pronunciation one, Eamon,
Dutasteride, yeah.
Dutasteride. And constantly needs to go to the toilet. Is this normal?
Yeah. Again, dutasteride is a medication. Ironically, that's used for bladder problems. But in some people, it can cause this particular side effect. Go back to talk to your GP or to whoever prescribed it for you, and they'll find something else more suitable for you.
Now, here is a question. One I think we've had a few times before. It's trying to get that balance between your sodium levels and your blood pressure. Listener says, now, I don't think I have a sex or an age for this person, but in any event, the question is, if your sodium levels keep going low, what can be done to prevent this happening? I'm on blood pressure medication because my blood pressure is high, so I gave up salt. I tried increasing the salt in my diet, but it had no effect. My sodium levels were still low. My blood pressure medication has a diuretic component to it.
Yeah.
Is that affecting my sodium levels, and what can be done to get my sodium levels up?
And our listener is absolutely right. And the situation is diuretics do cause a fall in sodium levels in some individuals. So you may well have to look to go back to whoever prescribed your blood pressure medication for you to try to find, see if there's something else they can use instead. Now, the problem is that while there are umpteen different brands of blood pressure medication out there, and even within the brands, there are many different generic versions of them. In truth, there's probably about 6 or maybe at most 7 classes of blood pressure medication. And each of them carry with them advantages, and each of them carry with them disadvantages. So in the first instance, you might be looking to see if you can find something else. I mean, if your sodium levels are falling all the time. Ironically, what happens, what our hospital colleagues often do, is that if somebody's got really low sodium and they can't bring it up any other way, they will give the person slow sodium tablets. So what that is, these are concentrated sodium tablets that releases the sodium slowly into your system to bring your sodium levels up. But that probably in turn again has an effect on the blood pressure. The key to this is trying to find that combination of medications that appropriately controls your blood pressure while at the same time hopefully not dropping your sodium too much. And this is a real problem. And the reason I'm saying that is that there are lots of people who have high blood pressure, and many people who have high blood pressure, one or maybe two agents controls their blood pressure really well. For some people, unfortunately, their blood pressure is really resistant to treatment. And you might need 3, 4, 5 different blood pressure medications to try to control their blood pressure for them. And the difficulty is we don't really have alternatives. There was a vogue a couple of years ago for doing a particular surgical procedure on the kidneys, because the kidneys control blood pressure. That particular procedure has fallen out of vogue again because the study showed that the procedure was useless. It didn't do anything for the person. So it's going to be back to your GP, probably to be talking to a consultant, because this is where the consultants earn their money in terms of trying to find the particular best combination of treatment for the individual that produces the benefit that minimises the side effects.
Okay, here's one from Mary. She has blood in her nose caused by hay fever, and she's wondering if you have any tips for her. Are we nearly out of the hay fever season, Eamon?
We're beginning to wind down. I mean, let's not complain too much about the weather. I mean, to be fair, we did have pretty warm weather, but compared to other parts of Europe, we didn't do badly, you know. But the thing is, it's been a long and muggy season, there's no question about it, and I've certainly seen a lot of people with hay fever and asthma and that kind of stuff. The thing is that in the ideal world, what you do is you try and identify the allergen, the thing that caused you to have the hay fever in the first place, and try and avoid that. Easier said than done. I mean, and for people looking at the weather forecast and looking at the very high, the days on the high pollen counts, sometimes the only thing you can do is stay indoors with the doors and windows closed, and that's horrible when the sun is shining outside and you want to be out and around. There are a variety of treatments, mostly anti-inflammatory medications, mostly steroids, that can be used to try to relieve the inflammation in the nose. I know that there are a number of desensitization treatments that are available but difficult to get to that may help reduce your allergy to these things. The problem is that when you get the inflammation, when you get the allergy, what happens is that all the little tiny blood vessels in the nose all swell up. And the trouble is you literally look sideways at them and they'll start to leak and you'll start getting blood in your nose.
Okay, I haven't come across that one before. Interesting. A listener in Tralee sounds like they're in a lot of pain, currently has muscle spasms in their back, and the muscle relaxant they're taking is making them sleepy, so they're only taking half one. The person says it's baclopar, 10 milligrams, and they're being prescribed half of one to one 3 times a day. Is there anything else I could take? I can't take anything with codeine in it.
Okay. I think that I understand where the person is coming from there. And again, they're caught in a rock and a hard place. The difficulty is that the consequence of muscle injury is that you can get muscle spasm. But the treatment for that is sorting out the muscle injury in the first place. In other words, you need to look at what can you do to try to reduce the inflammation of the muscles, and you, in that case, specifically use an appropriate anti-inflammatory medication. For some people, anti-inflammatories don't do the job, and very occasionally, quite frequently, people end up being referred on to the relevant pain specialists, as we've spoken about them before, consultant anesthesiologists, who will do various procedures, including injections in near to the spine to try and cut off the nerve signals that are causing the spasm and relieve the pain in that way. It's fair to say that the medications for muscle spasm aren't particularly effective, and for in large measure they have fallen out of favour because they give side effects and they don't really make any difference.
Okay, Eamon, we'll give you a breather at this point and give the listeners a chance to maybe send in some more questions for you, and to remind people as well, if you have a question for Eamon, you can email it to talkabout@radiokerry.ie. That's another way of getting in touch with us. Padraig is on the phones this afternoon, 066-7123-666 to call him. It's 16 minutes past two. You're listening to Talk About on Radio Kerry, and we're back with more medical matters in just a moment.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now we're chatting to Dr. Eamon Shanahan. We're taking your general medical queries this week, so please get in touch with us if you're feeling under the weather and you could do with some advice. Eamon, next question up from a texter. Don't know whether it's male or female, but this person says, I had a breath test done for Helicobacter pylori, and the result came back positive. What is the next step? I've taken antibiotics before, but it didn't clear it.
So the mechanics of that are that you go on to second and third line treatment. Helicobacter pylori was something that was very much in vogue, 15, 20 years ago, when it was found there was an association between infestation with this particular organism and recurring stomach ulcers. And there was a vogue there for a while of treating this, and it's still there. And I mean, gastroenterologists will still give people the appropriate so-called triple therapy to try to eradicate the organism. The breath test is actually a particularly interesting one. Very quickly, what happens is that you swallow a drink that has carbon in it that's tagged with radioactivity, extremely mild radioactivity. You then breathe back into a container, and the thing is, the amount of radioactivity that's in that container, the minute trace of it is proportional to the amount of bacteria in your gut. Anyway, the thing is, there is second and third line treatment for the eradication of Helicobacter. Best person to talk about that is either your GP or the gastroenterologist who'd have asked you to have the test in the first place.
Anne is in Listowel. At the moment, she has a stitch in her lower back and her hip, particularly when she lifts her right leg, as in going up the stairs. And she's wondering, what might this be?
Okay, so the area that you're talking about possibly is over what's called the sacroiliac joint. And that's a virtual joint where the bone of the hip, the iliac bone, joins onto the bone of the sacrum or tailbone. Best thing to do in the first, for most of these musculoskeletal problems, is go and talk to your GP. Go and talk to a physio in the first instance. Because what the physios will do is they'll carry out their own examination. They'll take the history, they'll do their examination, and they'll almost certainly be able to identify which muscle it is that is spasming, and then I advise the appropriate treatment to relieve that spasm for you.
Now, two more questions that are quite similar to that one. We've a 39-year-old lady who says she has discomfort and pain in her hip. She does a lot of cycling and is wondering what else could she do.
Yeah, I suspect myself our listeners probably heading in the direction of getting some form of scanning, possibly an MRI done. One of the things is that where we've got people, and it is a really good thing, and I mean, we're seeing a lot more people exercising regularly and doing good exercise, and I absolutely don't want to stop that for a minute. The problem is that some people then run into wear and tear as a result of the exercise, and one of the things that you may find is that around the hip you may have torn muscles. It may be that there's a what they call a bursitis, or the other possibility is that there is a damage done to a ring of tissue called the labrum, which sits around the hip joint. An MRI would be the way to show that up, so maybe to talk to a GP about getting that done.
Okay, and still in the hip area, we've a 68-year-old lady who broke her hip 10 weeks ago. She is doing all the exercises she was told to do, and she's also taking Panadol, but she's still in a lot of pain and is looking for advice.
She could probably use an anti-inflammatory as well as the paracetamol. The paracetamol is very effective, and the beauty about the paracetamol is that unless you take it in an overdose, it's a really safe medication, and very few people get side effects of paracetamol. But for somebody who has a lot of discomfort like this, then she might either need to do a small bit of codeine in with the paracetamol, or alternatively use an anti-inflammatory. A lot of the problem here is the rehabilitation after the operation. It's actually getting the muscles back in tone, and that can be a slow process.
Okay. Well, she probably needs to go back to her GP to ask about that, anyway. I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's an unusual one, but a very interesting one, Eamon. 58-year-old male caller. He says he never gets tired when he's outside in the fresh air working. But when he's driving, he gets very tired very easily. And also when he's sitting down reading the paper, he often falls asleep. And he's wondering, what's going on?
The poor man. Epworth. 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 Right? Google Epworth sleepiness scale. Right? And what you do is that this is a number of scenarios where the question runs from you never fall asleep at all, or you fall asleep all the time. And what you do is it's a series of about, I think it's 7 questions or something like that, 7 or 8 questions, and you score yourself on this, and it's the screening tool for sleep apnea syndrome. These are real classic symptoms of sleep apnea.
Oh, really? Okay.
The classic. That's the classic.
So if he Googles Epworth
Sleepiness Scale. Sleepiness scale, exactly. And literally at the top, the first hit, you'll see, click on the link and it sets, you get a series of questions and honestly answer the questions and score yourself at the bottom. And I can't remember what the scale is, what the cutoff is, but it'll give you an indication whether you've got a low, a moderate or a high likelihood of having sleep apnea syndrome. And obviously, if you've got that, you need to move on to your GP. And in fact, having done the Epworth sleepiness scale, that's going to make our job easier, because we can say, okay, fair enough, your score is such and such, you need to be seen and you need to be checked up for the appropriate. Now, if your Epworth sleepiness scale is 0, then it's something else, but you still need to talk to your GP anyway.
Now, Jack has a very interesting question as well. He says, will you ask Eamon what he thinks of the death figures from January to April 2022 in the UK, which came out last week? They are way up on the average. Medics in the UK seem to say that they're fearing a tsunami of deaths on the way from all the medical issues, including cancer, that were neglected due to focusing solely on COVID. Is that very likely to be the same here, asks Jack.
Hard to know. No, straight off the bat, no, I haven't seen those figures and I haven't seen any commentary on those figures. So, I mean, anything I'd be saying would be pure speculation. Funny enough, in just a different context, somebody asked me the question, is there a lot of missed illness out there? I think the answer is yes, there is. There's a certain amount of missed illness, but it's also, there's a couple of reasons. Part of it has to do with people's reluctance to seek help because they really wanted to stay out of harm's way. Part of it has to do with access to diagnostics and the fact that the hospitals were so flipping busy and still are very busy just dealing with the normal day-to-day stuff, but especially because of all the COVID that's going on. So there are worries that we are going to see a tsunami. I think there are other things too, though, Deirdre. One of the things, and I think I may have commented on this previously, when we were doing the COVID vaccinations last year, between the spring and the autumn, what struck me was how disabled a lot of our older patients became. So, for example, in the springtime, maybe two or three of our patients couldn't literally walk in the door of the surgery, so we gave them their vaccinations in the car out in the car park. By the time they came back 6 months later, that number had gone to about 8 or 10 people, if not more. So people, over the course of the 6 months, over the course of the lockdown, became very, because they couldn't get out, because they couldn't exercise, they became very disabled. And that's not going to be good for their general health either.
Okay, that's a very good point, and that seems to be coming up quite a lot recently. A lady in Tralee says she wants to know, does clinical depression tend to come back to a person? She suffers low mood at the moment. She's under a lot of stress in her marriage and at work. She's got a lot of brain fog. She's not on any medication. She's wondering, what can I do to help myself? I'm in my 60s and I'm a mum.
Yeah, clearly, I think the last bit is probably the most significant and most telling one of them all, because as a mother, you carry every single worry of the world on your shoulders, don't you? I suppose the thing about it is that the expression clinical depression, what does that mean? It's a label, and it just means that somebody has asked a series of questions and they have labeled a person as having this condition called clinical depression. I think the thing is like everything else in life, you're looking at a spectrum of things, between very mild, where people feel a bit down, a bit blue, through to the other end of the spectrum, where people are literally bedbound because they're so down on themselves. And everybody else is in between. There's no doubt that depression and anxiety are two sides of the same coin, and where people are very stressed, it would make them more prone to depression. I'm glad to hear that she's not taking any medication. Medication can be useful, and medication can be effective in terms of allowing the person to function if they have become so disabled by their depression that they literally can't get through the day. But the medication never, ever, 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 ever will sort out depression. Never, ever. Talking therapy is the most effective of all. But there are lots of other things that people can do for themselves. For example, get a bit of space for yourself. The sacrosanct, protected time that's yours and yours only, during which you can do things that you enjoy. Exercise is extremely useful. There's plenty of meditation exercises. There are, to be fair, and I think you can go into the HSE, and there are a number of free websites the HSE endorse, where you can get online counselling. And of course, there are not enough access, but there are counselling and psychotherapy services available, and your GP will be able to help you with that also.
Okay. Listener says he has a burning red and brown rash on both sides of the groin ball sack. What could it be?
Oh, yeah, I understand. Yeah, I'm certain it's a dose called in to try go on. It occurs in any part of anybody's body where you've got layers of skin coming against each other. So what happens is that the area becomes hot and sweaty and the skin becomes inflamed, and it's literally where the layers of skin are rubbing off each other. What's happening there is that because the layers of skin are rubbing off each other, it means that they don't get a chance to heal. And ironically, the problem is because the skin is broken down, you get an ooze of the fluid from inside the body out as well, which keeps the area perpetually damp. So how do you treat that? You probably need to talk to your GP to get a healing cream, but my own regime is that wherever this happens, it can happen around the scrotum, it can happen in the natal cleft, that is around the back passage, it can happen in folds of skin if somebody has a very, very big tummy, it can happen to women who have pendulous breasts, and it can happen in the armpits. Bathe the area gently once or twice a day and pat the area dry. Don't rub it dry because the area is very raw. Use the healing cream on top of that to try and speed up the healing. And then the really important bit is use dollops, big dollops of petroleum jelly, Vaseline or something like that. Because what the Vaseline does is that it acts as a barrier agent. It seals in the healing cream, but it also then allows for lubrication between the two layers of skin so that they're no longer scratching off each other.
Okay, hope that is of use to our listener. Here's a funny one. I think you've been asked this one before, Eamon. A listener says, I'm of the same vintage as Eamon, and I'd really love to know how he can answer all those rapid-fire questions at such speed. He has an amazing memory. Can he enlighten us with some tips, please?
Everybody has their own area of expertise, and no doubt if I spoke to people in their area of expertise, I'd be gobsmacked at what they remember as well. Look, it's the day job, it's what I do, this is what my training is about, and I do try to keep up to date as best I can. That's all I can do.
Yeah, and you know what, Eamon, in all the years I'm working with you, I think it's definitely more than 10 at this stage, probably 12 or 13 yeah. years, I've never seen you stumped by any medical query, however icky or embarrassing you, Eamon.
Well, I think the answer is that as a general practitioner, my job is to know a little bit about a lot of things. My consultant colleagues know a lot of things about a few things, if you know what I mean, a lot about a few things.